I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Charlie Newton. He's a crime fiction writer. His new book is called Start Shooting, and he will be appearing tomorrow at 6 o'clock in the evening at Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome, Charlie, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, MC. How you doing?
It's great to have you back. Now, we had you on just about 4 years ago when your first novel, which wasn't really your first novel, but your first published novel was published, Calumet City, and now you're back with another very much Chicago novel, Start Shooting. You were born and raised in Chicago, and Chicago is almost a character in this book.
Absolutely, yeah. Place is probably the main character.
How does that work? How do you think about that when you're doing it? Being born and raised in Chicago, does it just seep in, or do you have to lovingly portray the city as if it were yet another character in the book?
Both of those. I mean, I think if you go live where the story's going to be written from and about, then you know how to walk the sidewalks because you have, and you know who's standing on them, and you know what it smells like, and you know the politics after a while, and you ask a lot of questions. It's part of the fun of doing this is it's a backstage pass to some place you hadn't been. And I grew up on the north side, and the stuff in this particular book's all on the south side along the river. That's Africa to me. I mean, even though I live in Africa, it's new. It's I don't get it, so you got to go there and get it all over you and figure it out. And everything like that that's new is pleasant, and some of it's dangerous. But from a writer's point of view, it fills up the pot very well.
The main character, one of the two main characters in the book, is a policeman named Bobby Vargas. And like in your last book, Patty Black, the main character, was named after a real policewoman named Patty Black. Bobby Vargas is also a real guy.
Yes, he is.
Do you know him well? How did you choose him?
I know him real well. I start with a story I want to tell, something that inspires me, a series of 900-pound gorillas or political situations or something that I want to talk about, spend a year talking about it, and then I look for the people who could populate that story, who have backgrounds by default and access by default that would help me tell the story. And there are also people that I want to spend a year and a half with writing it, researching it. And so I knew this story was going to take place along the river, Chicago River, the Levee District. So it actually takes place in a neighborhood called the Four Corners, Hispanic neighborhood. So I went to a good friend of mine and said, that's a 12th district precinct in television police. And I said, who do you know in the 12th district? I need to know some serious stuff about what happens in the 12th district along the river between these two streets, Halstead and Ashland. And so my friend gave me a guy named Bob Anderson, who's in the book, Buff Anderson. And Buff took me to the gang teams that he ran, and I was credentialed through my friend Denny Banahan, who's a street legend in the city. And Buff told him, he said, this is my boy. Anybody that wants to talk, you can say whatever you want to him off the record. You won't have to eat it. So I just went off with the gang team for a couple of years. And
they let you ride around with them? I mean,
you have to clear that with the department, yeah. You're not really seriously at risk unless somebody starts shooting at each other.
The book being called Start Shooting.
But you're in these neighborhoods that you're not supposed to be in, and so you have to dress like a tack or gang cop, which is blue jeans and body armor and some kind of jacket if it's the winter, and nothing but a t-shirt and body armor. And you have to stand in such a way when they're doing a stop to where you're not going to make them weak, to where the other guys are going to look to put you together, which puts them focus on you and they get killed.
So
you have to stand. Yeah, you have to stand where they can't see your hand, your gun hand, and you have to be wearing the exact same stuff they are. So when I went out the first time, this actually happened with Patty. You know what an umpire vest looks like?
Mm-hmm.
And Chicago's colors are light blue. Everybody else wearing the skin tight, you know, Steven Seagal body armor, and they all look really Batman cool. They come out with this big light blue, you know, umpire-looking body armor for me and said, you have to wear that. And I said, well, that's sort of going to defeat the idea that I'm one of you. And they said, we don't care. We want you to look stupid.
So you were born and raised on the north side of Chicago. Let's call it the affluent suburbs.
I was born in the South Loop, which is the loop is downtown. It's okay. Kind of no man's land. And you're not really from the south side or north side if you're from there. And then we moved within the city to Damon and Jarvis, which is on the north side in the city.
I guess what I'm getting at is you're a middle-class kid, so to speak, and this is something I always wonder, because when I think about what it would take for me to write crime fiction, I don't know any of this stuff. And the question always arises, I read a book like yours, which is full of tough characters, scary characters, horrible people, and good people who are also really tough. How do you know these things, and how do you get to the point where you know them as if they were you, which is really part of the job of being a fiction writer?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's true. And the north side isn't a cakewalk either. It depends on where you are. There's some of the worst pockets in the city are Juneway Terrace at the far north of the city where abuts Evanston. Any big city is walking distance to get in trouble. And when I was growing up, if you saw the movie The Blues Brothers, Aretha Franklin has a restaurant on the corner of Halsted and Maxwell. And that was a real restaurant across from Jim's Original that I mentioned in the book. And back then, after Fred Hampton went down and Martin Luther King went down, it was still the DMZ between white and black, and every major blues artist you can name played on that street corner for free.
DMZ.
Yeah, demilitarized zone between North and South Vietnam. And so I saw Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and Junior Wells and everybody you can name sang on that street corner. And you'd go down there to buy switchblades and factory reject cowboy boots and stuff. It was a street market. And if you get involved in that culture, and then I got involved in boxing and horse racing, and you get involved in those cultures, you choose, do you want to be a football player and be with the cheerleaders, or do you want to be with the city? And I gravitated towards the city. It made more sense to me. It was more inclusive. I didn't do well with polite society, and I should have. I mean, you can't be born any better than 6 feet tall, white, male, American, high IQ, wealthy parents who cared about you. And for whatever reason, I burned all that to go look at it the other way.
To go hang out with the horse racing crowd.
And I say that, I think, in the book, in this one and others, that wherever the place that will accept you, you know, the boxing gyms where all the main fighters worked out back in my day, they accepted me, and the track accepted me, and Halsted and Armitage accepted me, and so, and Halsted and Maxwell, and the blues guy. I mean, you get down to this sort of lower common denominator, where their values are still ones you respect, but they're just more inclusive with them. And if you move uptown, rich people protecting their brand are not as inclusive.
The other main character in the book, point of view, first person point of view, switches between the two of them. One is Bobby Vargas, the cop, and the other is Arlene Dubois. She's Arlene Brennan, who is an actress who's trying to get the lead in Streetcar Named Desire. So she's a kind of a Blanche Dubois practicing for that part during the course of the book. This is also a person from real life, yes?
Yeah, I mention her at the very end of the book. She is a girl I knew in Haiti that got caught up in the government crime netherworld partnership and got killed with it. And she had very similar dreams to Arlene and I. And this book, while it's a gut bucket, brutal crime novel, it's about hopes and dreams. And Arlene is, what I say in the expanded version is, it's about hopes and dreams. Some propel you through the fire and some burn you to death. And if you pick the wrong one, marry the wrong one, like my friend in Haiti did, it'll kill you, and it did. And Arlene faces that same thing, where her dream, the actress dream, can be very poisonous. It's maybe the most noir occupation for a female that I can come up with.
You talked for a moment, we're talking to Charlie Newton about his new crime thriller called Start Shooting. And it's not a genre that I read that much, crime fiction. I actually, on this show, don't read all that much fiction because a lot of fiction that comes out isn't really that great, and it's hard for me, one person, to sort it all out. But I liked your first book and thought, well, let's read this second one. You said something when we started that I think is very interesting and very important. You said, let's talk about the, what was it, 800-pound gorillas?
900.
900-pound gorillas, yes, which is basically a way of saying things that are everywhere right in front of us that nobody's acknowledging. What are those things in this book?
The ones that I think are most important is you can operate from political correctness and just start with the victim nation that has now become very positive for everyone to default to. And so if it was race and you want to insult a black person because you're mad at them, you're insulting them because you don't like them, not because they're black. But it can default very quickly to that. And if you're talking
Well, depending on your word choice.
Yeah, but I mean, none of them. I mean, if you insult Al Sharpton, you're going to end up eating the race card because that's what he plays. And if you insult a devout Muslim because he wrecked your car, it's going to turn out to be that you hate Muhammad. And if you insult a religious right, it's the same thing. And our culture is just rife with that. That everywhere you go, and so in this one, I bring up a strong Hispanic component in the city, that Bobby's born in Mexico, which is true, and he's a U.S. citizen, as were his family, and he is rejecting the idea that he's a Mexican-American, he's an American. And the people in his neighborhood use that immediately against him, that you should be waving the Mexican flag if you live here, and if you're not, you're a racist. And so that's a serious component in it, dealing with poverty and the gang culture Chicago has. Chicago's considered a non-traditional border state by the federal government, meaning Illinois, meaning it has 100% of the components that all these border states have, the same kind of numbers and problems. Chicago has 600,000 Mexicans, not Hispanics, Mexicans. And Mexicans control the drug trade now. They've run the Nigerians out of the heroin business in Chicago, and they've run the Colombians fundamentally out of the cocaine business by becoming the transshipment agent, and they now have the power. And in Chicago, that shows. And I wanted to bring that up. I didn't want to insult all Mexicans, but if you're a Mexican in a street gang, we have 120,000 street gang members in Chicago. A stunning number.
With, as you say in the book, better guns than the police.
And no rules of engagement.
Right.
They can do whatever they want, and they do. You give a 14-year-old enough reason to go out and like the Latin Kings, have a ritual where to be made into the gang, you're going to murder somebody. I mean, that kind of cultural clash I wanted to talk about and not have to eat the fact that I was talking to a Hispanic or to a Mexican or a Muslim or a black person or a white guy from the suburbs. It's because you're a gang member that I'm talking to you.
If for whatever it's worth, that seems pretty clear when you read the book. Like, I never got for a millisecond that you were making statements about somebody's race or culture. I mean, it was a story. It's a story about individual people in this context, namely Chicago and gangs and drugs and mafias, some of which are underground and some of which are officially sanctioned by elected officials or are elected officials.
Yeah. I mean, I've learned how to try to remain completely fair and say that the reason this character's doing what they're doing isn't genetic code, nor is it cultural heritage from another country, unless it is. You know, if there was something from Greece that all Greek people did, and I can't imagine what that would be, but to where you could take an entire population of people and say they all stand on their head at 6 o'clock, then I'd say that.
Yeah, but
there is no such thing.
There is no such thing.
You know, they talk about the Arab street and black people in America. I mean, come on.
So this character, Arlene Brennan, I was reading the first chapter, which was first person Bobby Vargas, the cop, then the second chapter, Arlene Brennan, the aspiring actress. And they sounded remarkably similar in their tone to me. This is one tough broad. And it seems to me that the women that you write tend to be pretty tough and pretty streetwise.
I call them the tribe. And I think I can write first person as a female if it's not a fully formed feminine female. I couldn't ever do that.
Right.
That's way too complicated, and it's just a world that I'd be too unsure to even attempt. But a woman who comes out of her male side 80%, who's damaged, who understands the street, and it doesn't have to be a femme fatale. It has to be somebody who owns the ground they're standing on, then I'm writing about women like Arlene. I know a couple out here. I know people. I know women of the tribe, but rugby girls in particular, a lot of them, maybe a third of them, are like that. And I find that simple. And then the way they navigate, they can survive in the world I put them in. A really feminine female probably couldn't. She wouldn't be able to read the signs. She wouldn't know what to do. It's like people who pull guns and point them. The people that survive out there pull guns and use them, or they run, but they don't point them.
There's a scene with a large number of partying female rugby players in a saloon run by one of the characters in your book, and I'm going to assume that that's based on some kind of reality that you've witnessed.
Julie McCoy is actually a neurosurgeon, if you can believe that.
She's the saloon keeper in the book.
Right, and she's was the head coach until recently of the USA national team, women's rugby team. And that naked chair bowling that goes on in the book is a SOP rugby girl moment. That's how they break the rookies in after the tournament. I've seen it 20 times, and it's... Every time you see it, I remember when I was 20. That's what 20 looks like.
In order to understand what he's talking about, ladies and gentlemen, you'll have to read the book Start Shooting by Charlie Newton, who's, by the way, going to be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow evening. Let's talk for a moment about, and there's some references in the book. You say things like, I don't have an exact quote, but this is how it happens in the streets, not on TV. And so when you mention that a couple of times, I mean, these are quotes in people's, in characters' mouths in the book, but I was thinking about how most of what average people, shall we say, know about cops and crime drama and stuff like that is from the movies and television, and maybe from crime thrillers, but not from talking to people on the ground, not about reality. How realistic would you say this book is? In other words, to what extent do you have to use the conventions of crime drama? And to what extent can you really depict the street the way it is?
It's 100% accurate. And I use real people and real names. And the TV comment you make, a lot of writers use it. The way I use it in the book is the way the Chicago police use it, where they call the other guy the TV police. And they're not necessarily referring to television. They're referring to a guy that doesn't work very hard, that wants to look a certain way, that doesn't know anything about what he's doing. And it does mean the same thing by the time you get to the end of the lineage. It's what you see on TV. But they're really saying, it's another term is empty holster, and then an expletive after that that would define the person. The same 80-20 rule that applies to all businesses, all enterprises of 20% of the people do 80% of the work, applies to the police department. And these gang teams and TAC teams, those are tactical teams, are guys that really work the street. That women, too. People that really hit it, take big risks and do big things. And so I try to make it, I shouldn't say I try, I force the 100% reality on 100% real place, using real people most of the time, that although it's a fictional case or a fictional, it's... I try to put them in the box. Okay, I know what Bobby Vargas will do. I'm going to create a situation where there's no good answer, where it won't work out. No, there aren't going to be any heroes when that moment's over. There's just going to be, what would Bobby do? Then I write that, and of course, you know, everybody has to approve it before I can use their name, and nobody's ever stopped me. I try to write it true to what they would do, not what's going to be acceptable. Not what the Chicago Police Department wanted them to do, maybe after they had 45 hours to think about it, or what television would coin as a hero, but what really happens out here, that's that 900-pound gorilla again, is that Bobby says some things to some young people who are carrying rock cocaine for the gang. He makes some sexual references about how bad it's going to get if this kid doesn't quit. And that comes back to haunt him later in the book, because the politically correct world says, oh, maybe you're this kind of person because you said this, or you're on record as acting this way. And I like that really angry collision of somebody who's trying to tell you the truth and then somebody who has an agenda and who feeds that to you, destroys the truth and you. Consequently, many people, classic since Rodney King and cell phone cameras, many policemen don't police anymore. And you're starting to see that in terms of statistics in some places, that it's difficult for policemen to deal with the rules and regulations as they are and deal with the violence that's in the street. If we, those people who don't have to live in that violence, want to keep everything utopian, then we say, nothing wrong with that. That's the way it should be. The people that live down there are screaming bloody murder that the police aren't police in the street anymore. I find that argument fabulous because it's about the facts on the ground. And if we as a culture with diminishing resources want to deal with the facts on the ground like the war on drugs, and instead of throwing money at it, what we want to do is say for 40 years it's failed, we have to do something else, whether that's legalize it or something, but building prisons isn't working. It's easy to just gloss over that if we live here instead of the south side of Chicago. South side of Chicago is 80% black. And there's a huge crime and gang problem.
Well, I mean, there's the other side of that argument, which is there are Rodney Kings everywhere all the time who are beaten senseless when they haven't done anything.
I'm not saying Rodney King for driving 120 miles an hour through a neighborhood deserved it either. But had the black people who were in that neighborhood caught him, they'd probably killed him. That's not the point. It's not the point that policemen should be able to beat people outside the law. I'm not saying that either. But when you watch the tape of 6th and Western where those gangsters pull a guy out of the truck and beat him half to death with concrete blocks, who do you want to call? Do you want to call a politically correct police, or do you want to call people with shotguns? Because that kind of crime is real. And when that's near your house, you're going, oh, my God, I got to come up with a different answer. I'm not in any way saying what the policeman did to Roddy King was okay. In no way. But I am saying now that there are cameras and I grab you, we're looking at lawyers. The city's looking at lawyers. So the simplest thing, just put yourself in a policeman's role. You get paid the same whether you work hard or not, whether you try to stop it. And in this part of town, Santa Fe, New Mexico, parts of it at least, you don't really have to worry about grabbing people because you got DUI stops and that's about it. But in a part of town I'm talking about in Chicago, you got contract murder every day. You got people that are willing to do things that you can't comprehend, and who do you want to put between those really terrible people who live there and the really good people who live there who are 75 or 80 years old? The politically correct police or the shotguns?
And there's no happy medium? I mean, there's no...
I don't see it. And that's the problem. If the laws don't allow you to stop them, people who are willing to do home invasions, now, you know the difference between that and the breaking and entering? Home invasions where they kick down the door, come in, beat you or kill you to take your stuff. And they do it when you're home because there's probably not going to be an alarm on when you're home. And so they wait for you to come home. And home invasion carries a pretty stiff penalty, but not sufficient to stop it. So if somebody's addicted to crack cocaine or heroin or whatever and decides they need your TV, who do you want to call? And if you're in a neighborhood where people die in that argument, what I want to do is put that argument on your plate and say, that's really there. We're now policing Bosnia in a war zone. What do we do? And I'm not picking an answer because I don't have one.
Right. And the book doesn't have an answer either.
No. You have to admit, it's entertaining, right? Is the way these people, if you have an empathetic character, Bobby and Arlene, on an empathetic journey, their journeys, and then you put them in hell or versions of hell or you put them on a boat that's sinking, you care about it. And I get to put the 900-pound gorillas there, and you get to think, God, I wish that wasn't going on. I really wish this story could go another way. But then when you leave it, you're thinking about all the things you're thinking about. Well, what do we do about what goes on in the ghetto? What do we do about dope? What do we do about gangs?
And so your book is not only to write an entertaining novel and a crime fiction novel, which may even be made into a movie, and we can talk about that. Actually, we'll probably be talking about that tomorrow night at Collected Works. But it's also to raise questions about justice and reality and crazy, crushing poverty and racism and all those things in the minds of your readers.
Yeah, I think crime fiction is one of the few genres that allows you to really investigate the darker reaches of how we operate as a culture. And if you did that in a romance novel or, you know, juvenile or whatever the other genres are that are popular at the moment, the publishers wouldn't publish it.
Right.
Because it wouldn't fit the audience as they see them. But this genre allows you to at least embrace the harder parts of the world, and those are the parts of the world I know.
We're talking to Charlie Newton, crime fiction writer. His new book is called Start Shooting. Let's talk for a moment about craft and influences and all that kind of thing. What were your literary influences and fictional influences as you went forward?
Regarding my influences, I'd always loved Raymond Chandler, of course, and I never could figure out the plot, but I loved the sentences, and so the plot didn't matter. The construct of P.J. O'Rourke, before he became kind of a psycho Republican, his sentences. And then probably the most important was Hunter Thompson, that when he wrote Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, it was proof to me you could actually say it and it could show up in a book. You didn't have to join the Nixon Youth. Hunter Thompson told it like he saw it. And I was overwhelmed at the possibilities. So the combination of all of them is, there are other people that influenced me, but it was the combination of what those three brought, sentence structure and freedom. And I, as I said a moment ago, I mean, I've been around horse racing and boxing and anarchy and really tough towns and really tough people and hard choices that other people had to make. And I thought, if I can't make a story out of that I want to tell, that's what I did. People don't give me a microphone to argue with Al Sharpton. And I find him and people like him particularly offensive, the religious right and other people, the demagogues and pundits of our era. And I'm never going to be able to put the facts down in front of them without getting shouted down. And it bothers me that I keep having to swallow this crap that we're fed constantly. And as a writer, it empowered me to say, well, I'm going to tell a story, and it's going to offend a lot of people who live in the status quo. And I'm happy about that because I'm going to tell them what it's really like, not the empirical truth, but the operational truth as I've seen it, and then let them decide what to do with it.
So we've talked a lot about the themes in your book and the places and the kinds of stories that you have seen and lived through. Having seen and lived through it and even remembered it and taking notes is step one. Step two is crafting a novel. How did you learn that craft?
Probably the way most novelists do is that if you've read a lot, I remember my first private editor was just sort of stunned that I could put down the form. And the form's not really that hard. You know, depending on whether you believe George Pulte or a couple of others, there's either 20 plots or 36 plots. And that's been true since Aristotle. There aren't going to be any more, and they're really... You know, Stranger Comes to Town is one. And so you don't have to reinvent the story. You have to decide why you want to tell one of those stories, where how you fit, about your mom or the baseball team or whatever. And then you look at, is this genre crime fiction, and what are the pillars of that? A guy named Christopher Vogler wrote a book called The Writer's Journey, which is a deconstruction of Joseph Campbell's Power of Myth. And so I read Power of Myth, all the volumes, and I read Christopher Vogler's book repeatedly. And it gave you a way to calculate your story. I took that, though, and said, I know who's in this. I'm going to put them in this room, lock the door, and see what happens. And that's an Elmore Leonard kind of move, to where my stuff's 100% character-driven, other than the 900-pound gorilla. And so if I know the characters and I have an idea of what the story's about, the 900-pound gorilla, I just all sit down in a room, and you'd be surprised how quickly somebody dies.
Let's talk for a moment about the new world of publishing. What does the old world look like? What does the new world look like in comparison?
I got in trouble for saying this, so it's absolutely...
Santa Fe.
I said, the world has been run, like many elements in the world, by gatekeepers. And the gatekeepers controlled the distribution channel into a record store or into a bookstore. And if you didn't fit what they wanted you to do, you couldn't get distribution. And so distribution, like the Mexicans owning cocaine now, even though they're not producing it, they own distribution. And that rose to be the most powerful element of the channel. And for publishing, I said the gatekeepers are still out in front of the gates rattling the keys, and they don't realize the walls are gone.
What do you mean by that, the walls are gone?
There is no empire left. There's a gate, maybe, but if you think about a fortress if all that's left is the gate, then people are going to overrun the fortress because there are no walls left.
But, I mean, what is the walls? Books made of paper?
Digital is what did it. But if you think of the distribution channel was you'd toil in the dark. You have no guarantee you're going to get published or get paid. So 100% of risk is on the writer or what they would call the content provider. And that person then hopes to get an agent, which is really tough, and you're horribly marginalized along the way, and you've heard that story 1,000 times, and it's absolutely true. Then your agent has to go out and really fight through the gatekeepers to find somebody who will publish it. Finally, you find a publisher, and then how good a job do they do putting the books in the bookstores? You know, when you do the math on 30 books in a case and how many bookstores there are and they do a print run of 15,000, none of the bookstores are going to see your book. Nobody's going to impulse buy it. You're defeated by the print run now before you start. That was the old publishing model. And when digital came in, it was viewed as vanity publishing almost. And nobody really believed it had come to the point where it is now, where digital sales on Amazon outpace all other sales combined. They didn't think people 50 years older would embrace the Kindle and Nook, and they're the fastest growing segment of the buyers.
I know, and it's so, like, in retrospect, it's so obvious because you can change the font size.
Duh. And so publishing, like the record business, faces extinction of its old model. Probably not extinction entirely, but it now has to decide between you, the reader, and me, the writer. There used to be guys who drove trucks, guys who ran warehouses. There used to be all kinds of people that shared in this money. And out of a $26 novel, I might get $3. That's all. And in the new model, let's say the digital is, under the agency agreements, $13. Presently, they're discussing that as if I might get $3 of the 13, which is a much higher percentage. But I think by the end of the year, I would probably be getting more like 10 of the 13. And I don't mean me, but I mean anybody that wants to do this on their own. And now you're in a world that's run by passion-based media like this radio show, passion-based social media, where you're not going to jam a bookstore with 50, 60 feet of James Patterson on it and sold at a discount because Amazon blew that model up by selling them at less than what Borders could buy them for.
And now we have no Borders.
Right. Well, and that's because Borders bet it all on this bestseller, vertically integrated model with a publisher that would put all the little bookstores out of business. When Amazon came in, they became a category killer, where they said, well, we get a bigger discount, we'll sell them at cost, we'll annihilate the old distribution channel and we'll become a publisher, which is just what they've done. And you probably have seen, Amazon now has a button called Print on Demand. So all the people that actually want a book, if you didn't publish it with a major publisher or you didn't publish it hardcover, you can still get it just as fast, and they'll print them one at a time. Eventually, you're going to have a kiosk in a coffee shop, like you have ATMs out there, that via satellite can print any book in any library anywhere. Once you start thinking about what that does to the entire channel, the bookstore, New York Publishing, Bertelsmann in Berlin, all of that changes immediately, because now the only people that need to be between you and me are marketing and editing. Marketing and editing used to be the purview of the major publisher. And when they got into the big box, vertically integrated distribution system, they stopped doing that. And in my case, Jason Kaufman's a spectacular editor. And he really helped this book. And I say so in the acknowledgments at the end. So he provided me something that I don't know I could have gotten anywhere else.
Right.
And that's valuable.
We're going to have to continue this discussion tomorrow evening at Collected Works Bookstore because it's time to go. Charlie Newton, it's been great having you on the air. Charlie Newton is a crime fiction writer. The new book is called Start Shooting, published by Doubleday. And we will be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow evening at 6 in the evening. And lots of fun and good coffee and lots of people. So we look forward to seeing you there. Thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
A pleasure.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe Ben Swan and Trixie Con Queso. Ben Swan is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, and Trixie is putting on the Fab Faux Fur Fashion Show on February 1st.
Nicely done.
Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us, Mary Charlotte. Yes. Always a pleasure to see you.
And Ben Swan, happy birthday
well, thank
to you.
You. It's nice to
today
be 40 wonderful
birthday.
Again.
Yeah. Again and again.
And again.
So the Fab Faux Fur Fashion Show February 1st benefiting the Northern New Mexico Animal Shelters, not just the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, but also the Española Animal Shelter.
Yes, Española is also involved, and we're going to go ahead and all proceeds that we raise on Wednesday at lunch will split between the two shelters.
Wonderful.
Yes, it's going to be very fun. If you're a fashionista and you love faux fur, you've got to come on down. It's going to just be a gas. We're going to have models walking through the restaurant with faux fur, and they will be accompanied by handsome canine escorts who will be wearing the real fur, who really should the only ones should be wearing the real fur, in my opinion. But
okay, so you're not going to put a polyester boa on Fluffy the dog.
No, we're probably not going to go that way with this one.
But they could be attired in very attractive fashions, I'm
right.
sure of it.
Well, one of the little dogs will be wearing a bow tie, kind of like Chippendales, and he'll have a little backpack on that says Tuck a Buck. And so when he walks by, if you want to give a little extra money for the shelters, you can do that.
That's a
so
great
you're
idea.
Going to tuck dollars into the dog's belt?
Yeah, well, just one. He kind of looks like a handsome, you know, he's dashing. So, he's
so
a little tuxedo.
A Chippendale dog?
Yeah.
Chippendog,
yes.
So, this is all happening on Wednesday, the 1st of February, a couple days from now, from noon to 2 at the restaurant Or House at Milagro on 139 West San Francisco. Oh, yeah, that's kind of back in there.
Yeah.
We walk
right.
off San Francisco Street, 139 West San Francisco Street in Santa Fe, and a very low cover charge. For this whole event. So, but talk about the fashion part of it. I mean, besides the wonderful parade of dogs, what about the human fashion?
Right. We have some wonderful boutiques involved, including Origins, Uli's, Whereabouts, and let's see, there's another one. Mimosa just joined us. They're going to be featuring fashions.
And, of course, our retail store will be also
yes.
presented, represented there with some fashions. From
and there's some nice stuff at your retail
beautiful
store.
Beautiful vintage stuff and other awesome fashions.
Yes, both the cat, what the cat dragged in, which is the Santa Fe boutique, and also the boutique for Española that has found faux fur that they will be featuring on a model.
They
and
found faux fur that
they
they'll
did.
Be featuring. We got a lot of February 1st
that
F
is.
Faux fur.
I like those little word challenges, but that's me. And so they're called the Barkin Boutique.
Right.
They're over there by Albertsons. And so we have models from all
by Ginger.
Over.
Yeah, next,
yes.
to next door to Ginger
yes.
here in Santa Fe.
So we're really
that's
excited.
That's a good place, too.
Very fun.
All right, so that is all happening, ladies and gentlemen. So get your furry or to-be faux-furred self over there Wednesday from 12 to 2 at the Or House at Milagro on San Francisco Street. What else is happening? You've got all kinds of events at the Santa Fe Animal Shelter, Ben Swan.
Yes, we do. You know, February, I don't know, I just... Today I just thought to myself that that this is, you know, they call it the year of the dragon, but it might as well be the year of the feline because there's so many cat-related things going on in February. So, in fact, at the shelter, through the month of February, at the shelter's clinic, we'll be offering free spay and neuter green for indoor-outdoor cats. So that's the first 100 people who book an appointment during the month of February will get that surgery free for their animals. So that should be an awesome thing for that. And then
you're making I saw the design for this great t-shirt
oh, yes.
that you're making that says it's a black t-shirt with letters that says I'm into S&N.
Yeah,
spay
was,
and neuter.
That was it. That was it. Jay Oliver and I, a graphic designer, sort of worked on this idea and came up with it. And
sort of gothic lettering.
Yeah, we'll have it probably presented in February sometime, but we really wanted to bring it out for our National Spay Day, which is this year on March 3rd. It's a Saturday. And that's also free spaying and neutering for dogs and cats for the first 120 people. It's first come, first serve basis. And it'll be that Saturday morning at the clinic on 2570 Camino Entrada. And I don't know if you were at last year's Spay Day, but it's just a fun event. I mean, people are there with their animals. They're doing the right thing. It's all free, and it's just quick in and out, and there's an energy there that's really exciting. Because you're doing the right.
That's a wonderful thing.
You're doing the right thing for your animal and for all the animals, really, because ending overpopulation is one of our primary missions at the Santa Fe Animal Shelter.
And it is doable, Colorado being a great example.
It is, you know, and we've got wonderful statistics that show, you know, the clinic's been in operation for about 5 years, 4 years, and it's really made an impact on the number of animals, homeless animals that we get into the shelter. It's really having an impact, and we think this year it'll even show it more. So the more animals we can get spayed and neutered, the better things will be for everyone.
I like it. And you know, when you walk into the Española shelter, there's a big sign that says, have the cojones to neuter your animal.
Uh-huh.
I thought that was excellent.
No? Yep, it's true. And yeah. It's hard for some people.
It is hard, yeah. But you got to do it.
In our mobile spay clinic, they have their slogan is, it's nuts not to neuter. So we have a lot of fun with all that kind of
Ouch.
Stuff, you know.
All right,
sorry
ladies
about
gentlemen.
That.
Now, what about the cat contest?
Oh, yeah, we just finished up the cat contest, and I want to show you the award winners. Now, this was a photo online contest, which was really well received. This is the best in show, Lady Tula.
So you basically, I'm going to hold the pictures up to the microphone, and ladies
see,
and gentlemen,
yeah.
and see the cute pictures of the cute cats who really are very cute, and you can see them online at the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society website, and it's basically, it's not only about cute cats, but it's about good photographers.
Yeah, they really, you know, spend a lot of time just capturing the cat's essence, and this is our People's Choice winner, which I thought was kind of nice. We had this year, we let people just sort of vote on who they think the best cat was, and everyone voted on Brinkley, which when this is a shelter alum, and when Brinkley was at the shelter, he had sort of a head injury, and they called him Bobbles. But he's completely healed and has become this wonderful companion, a very finicky feline for this family.
He looks like he doesn't get to the gym that often.
That means life is good, right?
So, yeah, that was a fun contest. We'll try to do it once or twice a year. It's because cats, you know, the cats are wonderful, but when you go in, you know, they don't like bark for attention like dogs. You have to really honor them until they come out. And so you can't really have a dog show like the fashion show. You can't really get cats to walk along the runway.
Not the catwalk. They
Not
don't
the
like
catwalk.
It. No,
no,
thank you.
It's named
no
after
cats.
Them, but they don't like it. So that's why we decided to do this photo online contest. So.
Excellent. Now, you also have a lot of animals up for adoption. Actually, both of you can tell us about some animals that are adoptable and ready to go into the right home and be just love animals for the rest of your life.
You know, and there's one thing I wanted to point out at the shelter is that we have a lot of people who, you know, they have their own animals or they foster animals, and they really connect with some of the animals at the shelter. And they sponsor the animals' adoption fee. So basically, the fee is waived. And we're really focusing on some of those animals. They've been a long time at the shelter, and we just want to get them homes. And so I brought two that are just wonderful animals whose adoption fees are waived. And there's Freckles. Freckles is a one-year-old shepherd mix. He's fully grown, just under 40 pounds. He's a little shy, but he warms up with people quickly. And once he...
he's very cute.
He's very
yes.
cute, right. And I'll give that to you. I'll send that to you so you can put it online.
Okay, great.
So he can be a little... It's best that he just be the only dog in the family.
Right.
Some dogs are like that. Some aren't. And here is another dog. cat. This is Joni.
I was going to say, that's a
yeah,
cat.
Yeah, I know.
A dog in drag.
I mix that up a little bit all the time. So Joni is also one of our animals that is sponsored. So that means her adoption fee is waived. She's about 2 years old, 6 months. She's actually been with us since July. So she's looking for, that's 6 months. So she's looking for a forever home. And she's patiently waiting.
And she's very beautiful and pensive looking.
Yeah.
White with a few black markings.
And I also wanted to tell you that, you know, we do have the main shelter where everybody can see the animals and come adopt them, make friends and for life. But we also go out into the community and have adoption events almost weekly, basically Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. And this Friday, we'll be at PetSmart from 1 to 4. And anyway, we're at different places throughout the community, mostly PetSmart and sometimes at Walmart. So just check our website for our off-site adoption events.
Very nice. And you've got Trixie Conqueso. How'd you get your name?
Someone gave it to me. I can't remember. Years ago, they said, you look like a Trixie. And then just to fit in with New Mexico, we added con queso. So, I performed
it. And that's a character.
It's sort of a character that I performed on stage. I did Taos Pride, Albuquerque Pride, Santa Fe show doing that. So, yes, that's where I'll be doing the Fab Faux Fur fashion show. But I was going to tell you, I did wander into Espanola shelter yesterday, and I said, I'm just here to give you flyers. I'm not looking at dogs. And they said, well, don't you want to just see the Chihuahua section? I said, you have a Chihuahua section? Well, okay, maybe I'll just, you know, walk on by. I'm not going to lock eyes with any of the cutie pies. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
They are so tricky. You know what they do? You walk back there, and they say, oh, here, could you hold this one for a minute? I got to run and do blah, blah, blah. And you, all of a sudden, I'm holding this little white creature that was so nice. He was about to have his nails clipped, so he was very nervous. But, you know.
Chihuahuas tend to be slightly nervous.
He was, but they said they call, like, I have two Chihuahua mixes, Chaco and Cheeto, who will be in the show for their fans. And they have totally calmed down. We pick them up and carry them around and go places, and they're just fine.
So. How do they deal with strangers?
Well, first there's a little talk back. There's a hollaback girl, but they're fine. They get over it. No, it's okay.
I've met them, and they're wonderful. One was in my lap for quite a bit of time, and so the other ones were running around. So Chihuahuas, it's true. Chihuahuas can be a little standoffish, but they love to bond with whoever they're.
And we're not talking about true bred. They're mixes. So, yes.
Yeah, but I went up to Rancho de Chihuahua once, and
that's an awesome place.
It is an awesome place.
Where's that?
It's in Chimayo.
Wow.
And you can't just walk in, but you can write to them. And I've never seen so many loving Chihuahuas all in one place in my life. But anyway, so tell us more about.
So yes, at Espanola, they also have, of course, the lovely puppy section, which is very hard to walk by, and then various different dogs of different sizes. There was one little sweetheart they have in a separate cage. It's a min pin, and for some reason, he doesn't have any teeth. But he's just the biggest sweetie pie, you know, and he's almost fully grown, so he's figured it out, and they feed him the soft food. So he would be a special care dog if someone has a really big heart. That's the type of person they need to come in.
Well, basically, they just have to feed him mush for the rest of his life.
Otherwise, he's fine.
And beef jerky.
Right.
My mother had a Pomeranian who didn't have any teeth. Her name was Babe. She used to travel with her everywhere, but she didn't mind not having teeth.
It's just different, yeah.
Yeah, you might not survive in nature quite as well.
Right. So, but anyway, if you're a dog lover or a cat lover and you want to support them, I really hope you'll come out to the fashion show on Wednesday at Milagro in Santa Fe Plaza and raise money for these wonderful animals and the people who do all the work. We are going to have a table there.
Yes.
From both shelters, we'll be featuring some of their extra clothing and accessories that you can buy to help raise money.
Ben, anything else?
Well, yes, as you know, Mary Charlotte, that February is the month of love, and we're having an awesome sweetheart.
I think every month is the month of love.
How about every day?
Every day is
every
the day of love.
We love more, especially with animals. And to make it easier for people to love more animals, during the month of February, we're offering a sweetheart special. That means when you adopt an animal, the second and you find somebody, another animal that you love, the second adoption fee will be waived. Can't get any better than that. You can get a dog and a cat, a dog and a gerbil, a dog and a rabbit, rabbit and a rabbit, cat and a cat. Anyway, bonded.
And also sometimes there's bonded pairs, like two dogs who really need to be adopted together.
Right. We have that occasionally, and it's wonderful when they
or
can
or two puppies from the same litter.
It's wonderful when they can be at home together. So thank you.
And the Espanola Valley Shelter is on the web at evalleyshelter.org. And the
Santa Fe Animal Shelter is sfhumanesociety.org.
sfhumanesociety.org.
And we do have a Facebook event page for the Fab Faux Fur Fashion Show on February 1st, if you look it up. I know, they got me that one time. So you can look up more details on Facebook if you like that kind of thing.
It should be a lot of fun. They promised me that they were going to take a lot of photos at the event, so we can post them on the Facebook and at different places.
That's right, because you're going away.
I am going away.
You're having a little belated birthday trip.
Yes.
Well, happy birthday to you, Ben Swan, and thank you so much, Trixie Con Queso, for being with us on the Radio Cafe Fab Fur Fashion Show and the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and the Espanola Valley Humane Society, all wonderful organizations. Have a great day.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.